Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, I take what you made, but I got to put you down for a while. Well, you know I take what you made, but I got to put you down for a while.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for joining us once again on Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio. I'm Patrick Connor of Knuckles and Gloves, the Fight City, Hannibal Boxing, the Oregonian, you know, handful of other places. Who cares? We're here to talk some boxing, man. In just a minute, my buddy Bryn Jonathan Butler, author, filmmaker, roamer of New York streets, dude's going to be right here. We're going to be talking about the Riddick Bowe versus Evander Holyfield trilogy. What really gets better than a heavyweight, like a great heavyweight fight? People are still talking about Tyson Fury versus Deontay Wilder from a couple weeks ago. I mean, this is the kind of thing. A really good heavyweight fight is the kind of thing that just kind of lingers. It really does linger in our memory. And Riddick Bowe and Evander Holyfield gave us three really good heavyweight fights. The first one in particular, exquisite. Second one, it definitely had some drama to it for other reasons. And the third one, I think, was just kind of a bit of a wrap-up of the trilogy, but nonetheless still a very good fight. And that's what we're talking about today, the history behind these fights, what caused these fights to get put together, what happened during the fights, and what happened after them. That's exactly what these history episodes are for. We're going to be back also for anybody wondering, and they're listening in going, what? Why is Patrick doing a history episode with Bryn? Don't worry, baby. Don't worry. Aris and I will be back in good time, and you will never miss us. Well, maybe you'll miss us, but we'll be back. That being said, we got heavyweight boxing to talk about. Bryn, what's up, man?
Riddick Bowe, Evan Fields, trilogy.
Woo! What does he put at the end of all of his tweets? That's what's up, Bowe.
And speaking of Evander Holyfield, I'm juiced to talk about this.
Man, I'm just ripped. I'm just shredded, if you know what I'm saying. We're talking steroids.
I'm focused.
Laser focus. Yeah, I mean, you know, here we are. We're, what, 25 years removed from the first fight, and it's still, we're still lusting after it. I opened up saying that you can say all you want about heavyweights in the last, maybe 20 years or so, being pretty low quality. I mean, you know what? Quite frankly, from a history perspective, the heavyweight division has been pretty low quality overall. I know a lot of people are going to hear that and go, what? You got Joe Louis? You got Muhammad Ali? Yeah, but like, look at the spread of the heavyweight division during even some of these times. Not Muhammad Ali. That doesn't count because he fought in some of the greatest heavyweight eras of all time. But, you know, the heavyweight division is kind of crappy overall from a quality perspective. So when we do see a really, really, really good heavyweight fight, I mean, it sticks with us.
I think that's a really good point to make is we forget, you know, like even with Tyson on the way up, everybody said, who the hell did he fight until he fought the championship? But they said the same thing of Joe Louis. Rocky Marciano is an underdog when he fought Joe Louis because of what his level of competition was at the time. I mean, I think Jack Johnson fought pretty high level of competition and overcoming the race barrier and that sort of thing. But George Foreman, as an Olympic champion, was like a pretty considerable underdog when he fought Joe Frazier. So we have a great deal of historical revision that comes into play with guys after the fact in assessing their place in heavyweight history. But at the time, almost none of these great heavyweights really got their fair due. So I agree with you. I think there have been generally like a really dominant guy, and then we sort of dismiss the level of competition. But with Bowe Holyfield, I think everybody knew, even though in Holyfield's case a lot of people were dismissive of him as a heavyweight, that this was going to be a hell of a good fight, and it was much better than the expectations. And well, that was my cat. The hell is he doing?
He's into some Holyfield Bowe also.
I guess so. I've never heard him comment before from up on his tower. But yeah, so I'm really jazzed to talk about this fight. I think it's up there with Ali Frazier, as one of the greatest trilogies ever. That obviously is the greatest heavyweight trilogy ever. But this, I think this is a really, really close second. There's just so many interesting facets of it.
There definitely are a lot of interesting facets, and I think that one of the things that really has to come with a good set of fights that's going to kind of, you know, live through history or beat the ages, as it were, it does have to have some drama. There does have to be some kind of outside the ring nonsense, and there was no shortage of that in Riddick Bowe's camp in particular. But, you know, you look back, especially with the benefit of hindsight on this, and I mean, you're able to kind of put it in a slightly different light than we were seeing at the time. You know, I mean, you make jokes about Evan Fields and juicing and stuff like that, and they're legit and they're funny, but at the same time, it's true. You know, like, you're, especially when we're neck deep right now in 2018 in the discussion of performance enhancing drugs in boxing, what do we do about them? Who do we trust? Are we supposed to listen to this motherfucker who set up Balco, you know, 15, 18 years ago and is now trying to swoop in on angel wings? You know, like, where exactly are we in this discussion? And then you look back and try to put that in perspective with regards to especially Evander Holyfield and maybe Riddick Bowe too. And, you know, it takes a slightly different, weirder turn, you know? And, like, just to kind of piggyback off of what you were saying a minute ago, I do sometimes wonder at what point does a fighter go from they ain't shit to, oh my God, they're the best and I knew it all along? You know, because there's always seems to be that transition. Even with Lennox Lewis, it happened. You know, nobody liked Lennox Lewis when he was around. They hated that dude. And then all of a sudden, people are looking back and going, damn, we could really use that guy right now. It just makes me wonder, at what point does that transition come? And I don't know. I don't know. That's just heavyweight boxing too, I think.
Well, and it's not just boxing. I mean, it's all art, right? I mean, from fucking Van Gogh
That's
onward,
true.
We have a tremendous track record of being completely dismissive or ignorant of things that later on are, you know, some of the most valuable things that we value in terms of human expression or achievement. But in its day, our track record isn't great. You know, Godfather was that rare example of supreme artwork, but also just hit the popular culture. Everybody wanted to see it, and yet everybody acknowledged it was also a great work of art. There's not a lot of examples of that. You know, every Stanley Kubrick film that ever came out, even though a lot of people hold him up as being the great director in cinema, all of them were controversial. All of them were heavily criticized in their time, from Dr. Strangelove, where this is not appropriate, to mock the Cold War, nuclear oblivion. The Shining is not a good horror film. Lolita is inappropriate. Clockwork Orange is going to lead people to killing people. And now we look back on it and we say, these are masterpieces. None of them were really unanimously declared as that in their time. And I think boxing, it's very interesting. Just the change over time of how posterity can be such a strange whore to reevaluation versus contemporaneously appreciating the value of things. Occasionally it happens. I mean, lots of Ali's fights, I think people really understood how important they were. It is very, very interesting how we miss these things that are right in front of us and don't appreciate them the way they deserve.
It is interesting. And the funny thing also about this show, I think that, you know, you and I had previously talked about Evander Holyfield versus George Foreman. I thought, you know, of course, it's me talking about something I and you and I had done, but I thought we did a pretty good job of breaking down that event, why it happened, what it meant for boxing, you know, what was weird about it, what was different about it, why it ties to now, you know. And I think that for anybody who's like, what are they talking about? I never listened to that. I don't know, maybe click pause and go back and listen to that show now as kind of a setup to this show, because that's kind of, it's pretty appropriate in terms of the timing and in terms of how everything went down. You know, you have Evander Holyfield versus George Foreman, in 1991. Pretty big pay-per-view, big event, a lot of hype surrounding it, a lot of stuff happened outside the ring. Donald Trump's involved, that motherfucker. And you got all of this stuff that ties to 2018, but then it also directly ties to the Riddick Bowe versus Evander Holyfield trilogy, where you know, you got a guy with Evander Holyfield who defeated Buster Douglas, who, of course, everybody knows defeated Mike Tyson. So that was big news. You know, Evander Holyfield stepped up and smashed Buster Douglas in the third round, then fought George Foreman, you know, had a more difficult time than maybe a lot of people might have thought, considering it was 1991 George Foreman, bombed out Burt Cooper, you know, went through Larry Holmes and also fight with some more trying times than people probably would have expected, leading right into the first Riddick Bowe fight. I think a lot of the people looking at this fight thought, you know, we got a guy in Evander Holyfield that's a real small heavyweight. We're not really sure if he's really grown into the heavyweight division yet. Not a real big guy, not a big hitter, you know, very relentless, good work rate, but he's also fought these two old-ass former champions in George Foreman and Larry Holmes and otherwise smashed Buster Douglas, who might have just been a flash in the pan. A lot of people were going into this Riddick Bowe Evander Holyfield first fight thinking, we don't know who this guy is. We don't know who Evander Holyfield is in the long run. And we also don't really know who Riddick Bowe is, apart from just kind of a controversial knucklehead. So there were a lot of questions to be asked going into this, and I think that both of them answered them really emphatically in the ring, obviously. It kind of, all of these questions and all of the unknowns just spilled out into the ring in a violent spectacle that was, to this day, one of the greatest heavyweight fights, no question. That 10th round was absolutely insane. Hell, I mean, if you haven't seen these fights, maybe click pause on all of the podcasting, period. Go onto YouTube and watch the fights first, because if you haven't seen these fights and you're really into boxing, you're missing out. These were truly great fights that, oh, and the Legendary Nights, too. You mentioned that yesterday. HBO did a Legendary Nights on this trilogy, and I'm almost positive that's on YouTube also. Go look it up. It's really great stuff. And I mean, I think that both of these guys, the fact that they were able to define themselves against one another, you know, in a vacuum, that doesn't really work. But in this instance and in this era, it was perfect.
Yeah, I mean, this fight was billed as Battle of Freaks by HBO. I have no idea what that's in reference to. So it takes place on November 13th, 1992. So for listeners, to put Holyfield in perspective, this is a guy who had a very controversial go at the Olympics as a light heavyweight, turns pro as a light heavyweight. So he had to put on 30 pounds to get into the ring with Bowe, and he got a lot bigger after this in the rematch and against Tyson and all that. But this is not just the cruiserweight you've heard about with his great fights against Cowie, narrow victory the first time, knocks him out the second time, but this is a light heavyweight. And when we saw him move up to be heavyweight, where he's set up to fight Tyson, he's at the Buster Douglas fight, he's sitting front row watching Douglas stealing his payday, watching Douglas, well, rather, when he fights Douglas, Douglas earned the most in the history of boxing, $24 million in 1990 money. Crazy money. He's overweight, so Holyfield doesn't get the credit for that win. A lot of people undermine it. A lot of people still hold up. Yeah, like you've got the titles, but really they belong to Tyson. Tyson was going to take it back from Douglas just like you did. Tyson hit Douglas a lot harder than you did. So the credit's really taken from him. And as he's a heavyweight, trying to wait for that big payday against Tyson, fights Foreman after Douglas, tight, close fight. Now, granted, Holyfield beat the fuck out of Foreman, but he didn't look great in that fight.
No.
Against the very old Foreman. Then he fights Burt Cooper, and you mentioned, yeah, he knocked Cooper out in the seventh round. But if you go back and watch that fight, which I highly recommend you do, it was a firefight where Holyfield was almost knocked out. I think second round, third round, he was knocked down, and Cooper can fucking hit. And he did hit Holyfield, and Holyfield was dropped. So keep that in mind, that, you know, thinking of what Tyson was going to do to Holyfield and all that, Cooper did more to Holyfield than Tyson did to Holyfield, by far. And he almost became the heavyweight champion of the world, knocking out in a shocker Evander Holyfield. But as Holyfield always did, he came back. And so he gets his next fight against Larry Holmes before Riddick Bowe. And again, does he knock out a guy who's 600 years old? No, he doesn't. He wins a unanimous decision against Holmes. So a lot of people were saying he is just not big enough to compete against a modern heavyweight. Enter Riddick Bowe. You know, 1992, Bowe is young. A lot of people forget that Bowe is only 2 years younger than Tyson. Seems like he's in a totally different era. Only 2 years separates them.
And yeah, just a totally different expectation and upbringing, you know, like in boxing upbringing, that is.
Totally different. Totally different. I mean, Tyson is champ in 86, turned pro in 85. Bowe's at the 88 Olympics getting his ass handed to him by Lennox Lewis. So we just think of it as a completely different era. But, I mean, Tyson tried to get into and failed the 84 Olympics. Henry Tillman beat him twice as an amateur. I think Terrell Biggs beat him as an amateur. As an amateur, Tyson was a ferociously accomplished national champion. I think a two-time junior national champion. But wasn't, you know, the style didn't lend itself very effectively to that upper echelon. He was able to have these guys that really did nothing as pros gain victories over him. So Bowe is this big modern heavyweight, 6'5", 235 when he's in great condition, just is fucking enormous compared to Evander Holyfield. Holyfield may have the upper body of a heavyweight. He has the lower body of a middleweight. If you've ever seen him up close, the legs are like, it's just like Deontay Wilder. The legs compared to the upper body, the disparity is so egregious. It's really something to see. So this was a fight that just had a lot of expectations about exposing Holyfield, as you just can't be in the same ring with a guy this big. But then on the other side with Riddick Bowe, it's a guy that most people defined him as a very lazy, incredibly talented guy. And that maybe he's going to go lazy into this because Holyfield's so much smaller. He's having trouble with all these guys that are 85 years old. So there was, I think, that wonderful combination of a lot of mixed expectations about what's going to happen here. Both guys are undefeated, so we've not really seen them have to deal with losing or be knocked out or anything like that. So there's a lot of unknowns to this, as well as a lot of things that we found out that they were both able to transcend in this fight, which is, I think, what makes it so special and electric.
And, of course, you're not really going to be able to get away with talking about heavyweight boxing in either the 80s or the 90s and not bringing up Mike Tyson. He, of course, figures into this equation, too. Like you said, I think that a lot of the sentiment, a lot of the public sentiment, perhaps not as much in boxing, because I think a lot of people in boxing were a bit more privy to the rumors and they heard more about the things going on in Tyson's camps and corners and stuff like that. But especially especially the public, I feel like the prevailing thought here going into first fight, second fight, whatever, was kind of like, all right, here are these two guys we're pretty much just waiting for Mike Tyson to mop either one of these guys up. They're just placeholders. You know, these are not, this whole Mike Tyson losing in 1990 thing was an anomaly. Just look at what Evander Holyfield did to Buster Douglas, and Mike Tyson lost to that guy. You know, this was a mistake. This was not what was intended here. And I think that was really the prevailing opinion, was who are these guys? You know, who are these guys in the wake of the guy that we just had? And of course, that's not in, you know, history. That's not what it remembers. But I feel like that was kind of the gloss over a lot of this. And then as soon as the fight went down, and as soon as it was clear that, like, these guys are not just scrubs, they, like I said earlier, they kind of defined this meeting between them they defined their own careers against each other. I think both of them have like some serious dog in them. And I think that had they not had this, had they been slightly different fighters, fighters who are a little less pissy, fighters who are a little less willing to go to war, you know, we'd be talking about this totally differently. But they were both hungry, and they both wanted what was before them. Riddick Bowe, strangely, perhaps just a little bit more in that first fight, or maybe it was the size and punching power, the physicality that kind of won him through in that first fight. But it definitely has a lot of kind of historical tie-ins in the heavyweight division there between these three guys, or between these two guys in the three fights. And it's pretty cool to actually look back on, considering how it all played out.
Well, and a couple aspects of that also. One, Riddick Bowe had been Holyfield's sparring partner for a time. So Holyfield knew that the Achilles heel of Bowe was that he was somebody who would fade. He was never in great condition when he sparred, and Holyfield always saw him get gassed. So he planned his strategy along the lines of Bowe's going to get gassed in the latter rounds, and he'd be able to come back and take advantage of him and exploit that. What he didn't anticipate was Bowe, for the first time in his career, gave everything in training for this fight and was in the best shape of his entire career before or after this fight, or as an amateur. It was actually quite analogous to what we saw with Buster Douglas, where Buster Douglas had one night where he was in total precision as far as his training, his focus. He gave everything he had to be the best that he could possibly be on that night. And the rest of both of their careers are defined by never living up to their potential through a lack of discipline and focus. So Holyfield was quite overwhelmed in the middle of the fight, where Bowe really was never running out of gas. Pressure that he was applying and is, you know, just a devastating puncher. And somebody who's that size, the rare person who's that size, who can throw in multiple combinations, an incredibly fluid puncher for a man his size. And, it looked like, I think Holyfield, I only briefly talked to him once about this fight. He credited Foreman as being the heaviest puncher he ever faced in terms of the impact of the blows, but he just said nobody hurt him like Bowe could, because Bowe could just, was hitting you so many times in such quick succession. So there was a lot of Holyfield in the middle and late rounds of this fight, waiting for Bowe to slow down, waiting for the storm to ease up, and it just didn't. I mean, 10th round you cite as one of the great heavyweight rounds ever, where Holyfield was able to come back from just an unbelievable uppercut. Oh my God, it's incredible to watch. I don't know how he just didn't collapse like a tree when it struck him, but he did get up. And by the end of that round, he was fighting back, and Bowe was in serious trouble. But Bowe was able to close out the fight. And I don't think we ever saw that Bowe again after this fight. After this fight, he's never at the same weight, I believe, as he was for this fight. Certainly never looked like he was in the same condition. But Evander was facing the best Bowe that could possibly be, and a younger man than him. Holyfield, I think, is about four or five years older than Tyson, so about 7 or 8 years older than Bowe. So, yeah, it's just interesting dynamics, interesting drama, lots of surprises in this one. And both guys just showed what makes them legends of the division in the history of boxing.
And one thing, too, that Riddick Bowe did and really set him apart from other not only heavyweights in general, but other big heavyweights especially, you mentioned his size, and this was definitely during a time when overall, just kind of stepping back a little bit, the size of the heavyweight was definitely getting bigger, but many people were still skeptical as to whether or not that was a good thing. You know, does bigger mean better in terms of, heavyweight boxing? And we had seen a number of big fighters by then. There have been a number of guys that were 6'3", 6'4", 6'5", and over. I mean, Primo Carnera, like 6'6", but is widely considered one of the least skilled heavyweight champions of all time. I think that's probably a little bit oversold. But nonetheless, the point's there. Big guy, not good. And that was kind of the overall theme, that being bigger doesn't necessarily mean better. And we'd seen that many, many times in the heavyweight division, but Riddick Bowe, on the other hand, was a guy who was 6'5"-ish, 6'4", whatever, but was a great infighter, really good body puncher. And that's not something you even now, you don't see a whole lot of infighting or body punching in the heavyweight division. I was damn near shocked to see Deontay Wilder throwing shots to the body against Tyson Fury. I was like, where was that coming from? He's not a body puncher at all. But that's the whole point, is you just don't see it. And in Riddick Bowe, I think that that was part of what was so overwhelming about him. He did hit hard. He had heavy hands. Not George Foreman heavy hands. If he had, then goddamn, I don't know what where he would have gone. But he had heavy hands. He threw in combination. And he knew how to fight both big and small. And it was there were so many moments in that first fight where you could kind of see this, like these kinds of moments are kind of difficult to pick out sometimes if you're just kind of lost in watching a fight. And some people find this not entertaining. They find it not fun to break down fights like this because they'd rather just enjoy them. But there were so many moments in this fight where it would look like Evander Holyfield would lash out and, like attack. And then it was almost like he was in his mind thinking, okay, I got mine in. Now I'm going to step back and rest, except for right in the midst of having that thought, it was, I'm going to step back and, oh shit, he's hitting me. And I didn't think he could, and that was literally so many times in the fight. It was like, he was getting hit when he wasn't expected to. He was getting hit when he was trying to take a rest. He had just attacked and goddamn, he needed to lean into a clinch for a second. And right as he leans in, boom, uppercut, that type of stuff. And I think that that was part of what really overwhelmed him, was he could not have anticipated the quality of Riddick Bowe, especially on the inside. And, I mean, who would have with a guy that big? So I think that in that first fight in particular, like you said, Evander Holyfield was kind of waiting for Riddick Bowe to tire out, waiting for him to slow down. Riddick Bowe never weighed 235 pounds again, except for in, I believe it was the Galata rematch. And that was all an illusion. That was not actually Riddick Bowe. And that wasn't a real 235 pounds. That was he sweated out in a sauna, like unhealthily 235 pounds. And this was different. This was a Riddick Bowe who came prepared. Perhaps looking back at his career, this was it. This was the defining moment in the first fight where he got into the greatest shape of his career. He was able to put it all together in terms of game plan, in terms of execution, and he did it against a truly great fighter. Of course, again, if you're kind of panning back and looking at this and going, is this a Hall of Fame career or something like that, it's a little tougher, because perhaps that really is the only thing you can point to, because by the time the third fight rolled around, it was, circumstances had changed. But Bowe really did put it together for this first fight, and not only did he put it together, but it's a splendid fight to watch.
Absolutely, and I think also Bowe had a bit of a chip on his shoulder, and I think the critics had it in for him a little bit because of what Lennox Lewis was able to do to him. And then Lennox Lewis is fighting over in Europe, and Bowe ducked him. Bowe avoided that fight as heavyweight, as a professional heavyweight. And so this was a real kind of awakening of boy, if this Riddick Bowe fought Lennox Lewis, I mean, it could be arguably the greatest fight of that era, just given their respective sizes and toolkit. I mean, it would just be an extraordinary fight. I still just think Lennox is just too smart. He fought a lot of guys who were bigger than him. And, even at the end, like a kind of fading, slightly overweight Lewis was able to figure out a way how to win against a very dangerous Vitali Klitschko. But boy, this Bowe that we saw in the first Holyfield fight, I think it just excited everybody about his potential. This could be, this could be the guy. What is Tyson going to really be able to take this guy out? He's just so big and so skilled. And let's remember, after Tyson lost to Lewis, I think he was asked if you guys fought in your prime. And he just said, no, he's just too big. He's too strong. So it just had a lot of interesting features to it. Both of these guys had something to prove. And I think this became the defining fight of both of their careers in terms of what they demonstrated in the ring. I understand Holyfield beating Tyson and the odds and all that, and then the ear-biting thing, that's a different story in terms of its cultural impact. But in terms of the sport and the relevance of a fight like this, they're both undefeated. both really have something to prove, and both just gave everything in this fight. It's one of those fights where I think you can clearly see, like, they weren't the same person after they left this fight. They were never as good as they were in this fight. And I think it took a lot more for Holyfield, just because his opponent was just so much bigger than him and stronger. I never liked Holyfield as a person, but you just can't take anything away from him in terms of what he was able to achieve just being such a small guy relative to a lot of his opponents in his era. And he just fought everybody, and he beat most of them. And Bo, in the end, I mean, just has the one loss, which is kind of incredible. I mean, the weird disqualifications, as you say, against Galata. I think he was losing both of those fights. But, yeah, just weird careers after this for both guys. But just what an extraordinary moment this was. I remember at the time, I mean, I was only 12, I think, when this fight happened. But, I mean, it was just one of those fights where just everybody, every casual fan was talking about it because it was so extraordinary what we saw, especially in the 10th round, one of the great rounds in the history of heavyweight boxing.
And also, it kind of ties to something I'd brought up earlier about the previous show about Evander Holyfield versus George Foreman, but another kind of, I guess, slightly cultural, you know, tinge to this is that it's not as if fighting in Las Vegas or having big fights in Las Vegas was a new thing in 1992, because it wasn't. This was something that started happening decades earlier, that setting up Las Vegas as a fight town, that is. It's not new. But you look at Evander Holyfield versus George Foreman, which took place in Atlantic City. And I think that if you look at Evander Holyfield versus Riddick Bowe 1, 2, and 3, all three took place in Las Vegas. And it's not I don't think it's a coincidence that that's the case. And it's not a coincidence that Main Events was involved, you know, with Evander Holyfield with these. I think that what wound up really pushing a lot of these events toward Las Vegas, as opposed to the East Coast, was, believe it or not, Donald Trump's involvement in Evander Holyfield versus George Foreman. And the way that he fucked over everybody so financially so badly during that event, or attempted to, that they simply didn't want anything to do with any type of property or any type of property that Donald Trump was involved in, or any other kind of investment that he could get involved in New York. And I think that that was at least a reason, if not the reason. There's casino money, site fees, et cetera. A lot of it's financial. But nonetheless, I think that that's a part of why these events gravitated toward Las Vegas. And as we'll be talking about in just a second here, the fact that the rematch was in Las Vegas and in an open-air arena in Las Vegas wound up playing right into some of the biggest drama and some of the craziest fucking shit we've ever seen in boxing ever.
Ever. I mean, not even boxing, sporting history ever. The weirdest interruption, arguably, up there with Monica Seles getting stabbed during a match when she was on the sideline.
I mean, there aren't a whole lot of, like, those crazy-ass, like, sporting moments that I remember where, like, where I was or whatever when I watched or some shit. But, like, that's one of them, for sure. Monica Seles. Yeah, I remember when I heard about that. I wasn't watching it, but I remember when I heard about that. And I remember watching, like, the Olympic bombing, because I remember I was watching that interview with Janet Evans, and then there was an explosion in the background and shit. You know, like, these kinds of things, like, live in your memory. And funnily enough, that first fight, that was a day before my birthday. And on my birthday, so I had, it was my 10th birthday, and I got a Super Nintendo on my 10th birthday, which, of course, I didn't give a shit about any of the boxing. I wanted the Super Nintendo. But I remember my stepsister's then husband, or I think he was her fiance then, whatever. He had just had his birthday, and on his birthday, my nephew was born. But the only thing the dude could talk about when they came over to, you know, celebrate my birthday and I got my Super Nintendo was the fight that happened the night before. And I wasn't big enough into boxing quite yet. Like, I knew about it, I liked it, but it was, like, not something that I would have been arguing about or anything like that. But I remember at the time that it was like, you know, my brother-in-law was just super into this fight. Yeah, that's a good memory. But the whole Sandman deal. I mean, holy shit. Everything about this entire story, it's just like... Everything about the story of the second fight, too. It's not just the fan man thing, but everything about the story of this second fight was just like, man, I don't even know. I don't even know where to begin. I mean, I guess just begin closing it with the first fight closing and people going, holy shit, what a great fight. You know, Riddick Bowe is obviously a greater fighter than we had realized and blah, blah, blah. You know, he wound up beating the ever-loving shit out of Michael Doakes in the following fight, dismissing Jesse Ferguson. Jesus. What an insane event.
Just to conclude the first fight, after that 10th round with Holyfield coming on, Bo comes back in the 11th and drops Holyfield. Holyfield covers his head and kneels to the canvas to avoid more shots that might have taken him out. Survives the round, they go to the 12th, and Bo wins it in a pretty clear decision. So the rematch, I mean, Holyfield got a lot bigger. I guess he wasn't training hard enough in the first fight, so he found a way to put on another 10 pounds and be 40 pounds bigger than when he entered the pro ranks. So Evan Fields took to the ring in the rematch, but as you say, it's this tremendous rematch. It's just as good as I think everybody wanted it to be. And in the 7th round, Holyfield looks away from Bo suddenly because he spots something and says to Bo, look up. And like it sounds like a cartoon, like Bugs Bunny tricking Elmer Fudd. And what does Bo see? A guy in a fucking parachute trying to land in the ring, who would have landed in the ring, but he got his fucking chute caught in the lights. I mean, this guy could easily have fallen directly at speed into anybody in that crowd and killed them, including, like, you know, the families of these two fighters who were probably in the front row.
But it's, I mean, honestly, that's not being melodramatic. Like, he literally, I mean, this was a dude parachuting in.
Yeah, with, like, a fucking fan behind him to direct him. But, I mean, clearly, if this guy had done anything wrong, I mean, we're lucky that he got caught up in the lights so that he, you know, landed much softer than he probably would have. But, I mean, anybody he would have hit or a number of people that he might have hit could easily have lost their lives. Like, this reckless, rank piece of shit trying to gain attention in the middle of the fight didn't give a fuck about the harm he might have done, but it delays the fight under the most bizarre, surreal circumstances. And, who knows the way that fight would have gone had it not had this interruption. I mean, what a weird thing to have, you know, quite a duration of time just accounting for this fucking asshole who, by the way, got pummeled unconscious almost immediately when the crowd got a piece of him. But, I mean, Bo's wife fainted at what happened and had to be taken to the hospital immediately after this happened. And it took 20 minutes for them to restore order and start the fight up again, where, you know, it's just such a weird, I can't think of another example of something like this in boxing. Like, there's just nothing comparable to it. And Holyfield's able to find a way to a majority decision to win the fight. But what most people were talking about, sort of like the ear biting incident, was this fan man, as he became known, and all of that whole wild ordeal.
Yeah, it was, I guess the only thing that I can think of that would be even remotely similar to this, there actually have been several cases, almost all of them were in either the late 1800s or the early 1900s, no, I'm sorry, I don't think any were in the 1800s, the early 1900s, where there had been cases where arenas had been built for certain fights or events, and they had been, of course, shoddily built because that saves money. And in more than one case, during the fight at least part of the bleachers collapsed, and I think in every case there were deaths. And they wound up having to delay the fight. But, I mean, that's going back quite a ways, and those things were not on television, broadcast live. So kind of getting into a little side discussion about this Fan-Man thing, and it totally ties into the trilogy here. So Riddick Bowe was managed by a dude named Rock Newman. Rock Newman, if I'm not mistaken, claimed to be half black, something like that.
It was part of the story. Which is way more egregious than Elizabeth Warren pretending to be Indian when she's 1/1000th Indian, Native American, I should say.
I mean, the dude looked like fucking Orson Welles or something. Like, he did not look black in the slightest. But, I mean, it doesn't even matter what he looked like. That's not even the point. The point is that the dude said that as a way to kind of claim credibility, essentially. He wanted street cred, so he was like, I'm half black. And on top of that,
he's the original Rachel Dolezal.
Yeah, that's probably not far off. And similarly, he tried to, I mean, I hesitate to phrase it like this. I just don't really know exactly how else to phrase it, but he tried to act black. He tried to give himself street cred by talking with a swagger, walking with a swagger, dressing like a pimp, rolling with a massive posse, blah, blah, blah. And the whole point is, regardless of how awfully I'm phrasing this, he was a dude who was a massive troublemaker. Wherever they went, wherever their posse went, you could expect some sort of fight, some sort of confrontation. Somebody was getting hit with some sort of communication device, guaranteed. And basically, you know, you got Riddick Bowe against Elijah Tillery in their first fight. Mm-hmm. Riddick Bowe, miraculously, in 1991, Riddick Bowe wins. How did he win that disqualification? I don't even know how they parsed out who was responsible for what. But Riddick Bowe won against a guy named Elijah Tillery. He won it by disqualification. Long story short, at the end of the first round, Bowe starts, you know, jabbering and jawing at Elijah Tillery as the bell rings. They're starting to go back and forth. And Riddick Bowe reaches out and hits him after the bell. Elijah Tillery, you know, they kind of scuffle, and then Elijah Tillery starts trying to kick him. And then Riddick Bowe tries to push him against the ropes. Rock Newman and I believe Riddick Bowe's, like, cousin or somebody like that comes over, and they snatch Tillery, like, by the neck and drag him, like, head first backwards over the ropes and start beating his ass. Somehow, out of this chaotic situation, they figure that Riddick Bowe should win by disqualification. I don't know how they came to that conclusion, because it made no sense. It probably should have just been a no contest, since they were both mutually fighting after the bell. Regardless, you know, I'm not Patrick Connor, boxing official. So, point is, you know, this was probably the best example prior to the second Evander Holyfield fight of getting to see Riddick Bowe's posse in action. And after this dude, the fan man, as they call him, crashes into the side of the ring or into kind of the lights and then gets tangled up in the ropes, it just so happens to be not far from Riddick Bowe's posse and where everybody who's supporting him in his corner are, sitting there watching the fight and everything. But they run over, they drag this dude from the side of the ring. It's a combination of security and Riddick Bowe's crew grabbing this dude off of the side of the ring. And then all you could see is, who is it? It was his cousin again or whatever, with a fucking walkie-talkie sitting there smashing this dude in the head with a walkie-talkie going after him. Like, I don't even know how do you go from here to here in boxing? I don't know, but it always seems to happen. And this is one of those things where it never gets less crazy, no matter how many times you watch it. And you go back and like watching the later on in the broadcast and shit like that, and they have like the blimp view of this dude gliding down the entire way. because HBO caught it. HBO, and I'm pretty sure they mentioned this on the Legendary Nights, but HBO's production crew saw this dude gliding around. And so they had footage of him gliding around from quite a ways, but I don't think they realized what he was going to do, you know? And it's just crazy. And like you said, this dude wound up committing suicide, like 2000 or something like that, a number of years later. But he was basically found in the middle of the desert hanging from a tree or something like that. I mean, Jesus Christ, dude. Like, how is this not an insane movie yet? How is this not a movie where nobody believes anything ever, like, that it's based on happened yet?
Well, I mean, it's all preamble to the really important heavyweight that emerged during this time, who, of course, Holyfield fought after the third fight with Bo, Bobby Chez, the smartest man ever to get four DUIs and change New Jersey legislation that once you get a DUI, we have to look at your entire driving record, which I think it's another thing that he's just not heralded for assisting, you know, the victims of the 10,000 people that are killed every year from drinking and driving. But Chez really made a major martyr-like sacrifice of not being able to drive until 2025 when he gets his license back. Now, I'm, again, beating this drum. I don't know why I have to return to Chez, but I think the Fan-Man thing is really fucking disgusting because thank God he didn't hurt anybody, but this guy easily could have killed many people doing a stupid stunt. He didn't, thank God, but it's really hard for me to feel much compunction for this guy. You know, whatever guilt he felt for what he did, he should have felt guilt. This was terrible, terrible what he did just for stealing exposure, you know, trying to be a weird Lee Harvey Oswald stuntman in this fucking open door arena where he's dropping into. But it was terrible. I mean, I don't want to see anybody get beat up the way he did, but I can totally understand that sentiment. I mean, if I'm next to family and friends and this guy almost kills them, I don't think I would have not wanted to take a shot at him for doing it. And could have killed the two guys in the ring. You know, he's trying to land in the ring.
That's another thing, yeah.
You know, so both of these guys, you know, it's just crazy. And you know, as I say, we look back on it, it's kind of like a funny thing because, like, oh, what? It's boxing. Look at this crazy lunatic. But this lunatic easily
even for
could have
boxing,
hurt a lot of people.
You know, there are these types of – yeah, there's these types of incidents where it's like, you know, we joke pretty constantly that boxing's pretty filthy and that there are crazy things that happen that should, blah, blah, blah. And that's true. Like, it's definitely taken to the extreme, but it's true. Boxing is filthy. Boxing is crazy. Stupid shit happens in boxing all the time. And boxing is nonsensical enough to be able to just say it's crazy and move on. And there's nothing wrong with that. But there are these kinds of things that happen in boxing that even for boxing are fucking nuts, dude. And this is definitely one of them. You know, the what's it called? What was dude's name? The Harlem Hammer. You know, the dude who Richard Grant, sucker punched Richard Grant after the fight in 2001.
Yeah,
like,
right. Butler.
Butler, there you go. Yeah, James Butler. You know, there are these incidents like these where people are just like, yeah, that's just what happens in boxing. And you want to say, yeah, that's true. That is what happens in boxing or whatever. But still you're looking at this and going, no, no, that's not what I enjoy about boxing. That's not what I want in boxing. That's not what, you know, like, this is bad. This is crazy. Even for boxing, this is not supposed to happen. You know, the unexpected is fine. This shit is not okay. And, you know, interrupting any kind of sporting event or whatever, anything like that is just, it's stupid. But like you had also kind of said, though, getting back to the actual fight portion of this, it actually did have an effect on the fight itself. Riddick Bowe seemed as if he was coming on when this dude landed into the damn ring in the seventh round, and it appeared as if he was going to win the second fight, too. They got about an 18, 20-minute or whatever respite, and they both got to rest. And Evander Holyfield basically, you know, got a second wind or whatever and was able to do very well to finish out the fight and wound up winning a majority decision Some people felt he didn't win or should not have won. Some people felt they should have called off the fight the second that shit happened. Some people made the suggestion that they should resume the fight on a different day. I mean, I don't know how you make that decision. I don't know what you do. But regardless, that's what they did. They carried on the fight after about 20 minutes, and Evander Holyfield won. So quite literally, this dude, James Miller, fan man, changed the course of heavyweight history in doing what he did.
And thank God he did, because otherwise we would have never seen Holyfield, Bobby Chez, you know, the fight that gave us Mike Tyson, Holyfield. You know, the real catalyst for change in the heavyweight division was Mike Tyson watching Holyfield versus Bobby Chez, which gave us Holyfield Tyson. Thank you.
It's basically, it's a bumper sticker. No, no fan man, no Holyfield Chez, and then no fan man with a K and an N. No fan man, no Holyfield Chez.
And then people would have listened to Gary Hart predicting 9/11, no 9/11. Boxing is the most important thing in the entire world.
It's one of those all-encompassing tie-ins. You can't get away from it. There's always the San Diego connection, and there's always the boxing connection. Everybody knows that.
Oh, no, everything comes down to Tony Gwynn and chewing tobacco.
Pretty much. You could slide that into any anecdote. So
pretty much,
this fucking fan man guy literally changes the course of heavyweight history here in inserting himself into the situation. Holyfield gets a second win, takes the majority decision, and it actually would wind up being a few years after that. It wouldn't be a few years after that till they wound up getting in the ring for the third time. And Riddick Bowe, you'd mentioned this earlier, and I think that it's no small thing, and it's especially in hindsight, you can't understate it, that these guys took something from one another, clearly. With Riddick Bowe, I think that it might be a little more difficult to pinpoint because of how self-destructive he was in a number of different ways. He did not treat his body well. You know, he... In terms of like letting himself get out of shape and stuff like that, ballooning in weight. And then on top of that, one of the things that Eddie Futch used to say, and I think that I've brought this up on the show before, but nonetheless, I'll repeat it because this is something that's important and something that boxing fans should keep in mind when they're whining about fighters being pussies and things like that. Riddick Bowe literally left himself in the gym. Something that Eddie Futch, his trainer, used to say was that the reason why Riddick Bowe got so messed up in the head was because he was constantly sparring, that he was never doing road work. He never wanted to do any of the workouts. He never wanted to do the earnest work in the gym. He never wanted to do that rote, boring, fucking, you know, 6 hour a day bullshit where you're hitting a bag or hitting pads or doing sit-ups, working your neck out. He never wanted to do those things. He never wanted to wake up early. He wanted to either party or eat his ass off or on, whatever. And the reason why he was ever able to stay in any semblance of shape, any fighting shape, was because he loved to fight and he loved to get into the ring and spar. And that even Eddie Futch used to tell him, stop sparring so much. You're getting hit in the head too much. And on top of that, this is a bit of a debate in recent years. And I'm sorry if I'm getting off the rails, but again, I'm trying to help people understand how this ties into the wider, you know, the bigger picture, the wider view. There's been a debate in the last handful of years, and one of the reasons why headgear has been taken off of Olympic fighters is because of this debate that says that if you wear headgear, you're actually not helping. You're hurting more because you're allowing yourself to absorb more blows to the head. And we now know scientifically that it is not concussions, but blows to the head that causes chronic traumatic encephalopathy, CTE, that the disease that essentially atrophies your brain and eventually causes you to more or less go insane and kill your fucking family. I mean, and I don't say that jokingly. I say this is a very destructive thing. And you could see this type of thing playing out in real time with Riddick Bowe as he's kidnapping his fucking family. You know, I mean, I don't know if you remember that shit. I remember it.
Oh, absolutely.
But,
absolutely. No, you join the military and
for like a day and a half.
Yeah, and listen to his speech patterns. Like a lot of fighters, listen to how their speech changes from year to year. And Bo is a prime example of this. Like,
you can hear it.
When I interview, you can hear it. You can hear it. The slurring, loses track of whatever the hell he's saying. And he was a reasonably, like, well-spoken, good-humored interview early on in his career. Like, he had personality, but toward the end of his career, and he only lost once. And another thing I just wanted to point out is I think you're absolutely right. A lot of people don't think about, for every one of these big fights, how much sparring is involved in the lead-up, where they're taking piles of shots. And people like Muhammad Ali were famous for having incredibly good sparring partners, like Larry Holmes in his prime in the lead-up to, like, major fights, beating the fuck out of Ali in sparring. So much so that, like, the writers who would watch would be like, oh, my God, like, what is he doing? Like, he's just being completely dominated by this young guy. And Ali's thing was to try to develop the ability to deal with pain, to deal with getting hurt and injured and you know, probably these, like, micro concussions and that sort of thing. But all of that impact, all that cumulative impact, like, that's going on, way more damage and impact is going on in the lead up to these fights than often happens in the fights themselves. And that's true of every fighter you're seeing. What's necessary could be 100, 200 rounds of sparring against really good competition in many cases. You know, a lot of the big fights, when you hear about, like, especially in the heavyweight division, who the sparring partners were to mimic, you know, Holyfield getting ready for Tyson, was sparring David Tua on a regular basis, one of the hardest hitters of that decade. So, yeah, it's just something that I think is a really important thing to underscore for people that don't realize, like, what the regimen is to get ready for something like a championship fight. But, I mean, like, it's brutal, the sparring. I mentioned it, like, being in Deontay Wilder's camp, watching him spar basically journeyman. I thought he was losing the majority of those rounds before the Fury fight. And you're just thinking, like, he's not fighting little guys. He's fighting guys who are comparable in size to Fury. They're 6'5", 6'6", 250. You know, and he's sparring, I don't know, 100, 200 rounds in the lead-up to Fury. A lot of impact from that shit on the brain.
It's cumulative. It's cumulative. It's not something that it's like, you know, you're able to erase it. You just do some exercise or you eat well, you know, and it goes away. No, that's irreversible damage. And, of course, the quick answer to that is these guys choose this. They know what they're doing. That's true. They're, you know, nobody's holding a gun to their head. At least I hope not. And if they are, you know, the safe word is pancake. Say it now. But nobody's forcing these guys to get in the ring and make these decisions. That's fair. But the thing is, you should still have all of the information. If you're going to cheer this on, if you're going to support this, then you should know what's happening. And, you know, that's why we talk about these things, and that's why, you know, I'm sure there's some people pushing stop or exiting out of this right now because it's uncomfortable. I get it. It causes cognitive dissonance. I get it. How do you reconcile the fact with, you know, the fact that you know what's happening to these fighters with the fact that you're cheering it on and paying for it? I don't know how you reconcile it. I've been a boxing fan for fucking 20-something years. I don't reconcile it. It just, it is, you know? Point is, this is what's happening, and this is what happened to Riddick Bowe. This is what his legendary trainer, Eddie Futch, said happened. It's not a mystery. So you get to see this playing out in real time during this trilogy, too, outside of the ring. And leading into the third fight, you know, it's pretty crazy stuff the way that this all played out. And then, like you mentioned, the steroid thing, realizing that, you know, in hindsight, Evander Holyfield was juicing his frickin' face in this entire time, and that's what accounted for. I mean, if you look at, like, they had lead-ups and stuff like that to these fights, And you could see him talking in interviews about how they're incorporating weight training into his regimen, and you know, no fighters had really ever done that before, and that's what they're doing, and blah blah blah. You know, it's in hindsight, it's far more sinister, you know, than just a guy trying some new routines, you know, like some new stuff. It's pretty nasty, you know, to see that this is kind of right in the middle of it. But nonetheless, going into the third fight, it was clear that some luster had been lost because of what had happened in the first two fights.
Oh, no question. No question. And I agree with you about the steroid thing. I mean, we're teasing about Holyfield, but I mean, he's doing damage that he wouldn't otherwise be able to inflict as a result of cheating. You know, he's elevating himself, you know, like Lance Armstrong saying, there's a chemical barrier and I can't compete with guys because of this chemical barrier, so I'm leveling the playing field. We don't know how many guys were cheating, and the better position you're in because of, you know, coming off the Olympics or the money you have, you're using an advantage in boxing that is potentially leaving them, you know, like severely damaged so that you can make more money. And, you know, I just think it's different in boxing than it is for, say, Mark McGwire to become like a home run champion, where what we're talking about is your knockout percentage is going to go way up, that you're just dealing with like a different body that you're able to wield otherwise if you weren't cheating. So Holyfield, as much as he was preaching godliness behind the scenes, apart from starting like a village of illegitimate children, was cheating, like just cheating ruthlessly to gain advantage to hurt people. So, you know, that body that he acquired toward the end of his career, or I guess mid-career, I should say, but, you know, there were piles of other guys cheating too. Tommy Morrison readily admitted to juicing his entire pro career practically. You know, he's one of the most devastating punchers in the division during that era. How much of that was just cheating? Like, if Barry Bonds is going from 49 home runs to 71, what's the equivalent in boxing? I don't know, but I bet it's a lot. You know, like, if it's that kind of impact with how far you can hit a baseball, how hard is your uppercut or your left hook while you're juicing? You know, so I don't think that's – I mean, it's part of my chip on my shoulder about Holyfield is just the hypocrisy of him just always grates. You know, it just makes me kind of grind my teeth whenever he's preaching about shit. But he's not a bad guy. And I did just want to say, when I spoke with Holyfield, Bo was at the same gym, the so-called heavyweight factory in Hollywood, Florida, along with Shannon Briggs. And Bo is in really, really bad shape mentally. Like, he just – it looks like it's 20% of the person that he was is left – in his consciousness, like just the lights aren't on when you're looking at him. And I didn't spend long talking to him, but he just sits there like some kind of ogre and just seems like there's just nobody there. And I'm not trying to disparage somebody that has severe mental health issues or early onset CTE or all of that, but it was just really, really sad to see where he's at right now.
It is, and, you know, especially when we're able to look back and see everything that happened. Like, so another narrative that was attached to both the rematch and the third fight was the fact that Evander Holyfield had been dealing with a heart issue, and not just a heart, like not just like a, some, you know, he's having some like palpitations or, you know, some shit like that could potentially be pretty much nothing. You know, there was an issue with one of the chambers in his heart. He had a widening gap in one of the chambers of his heart that was basically one of the valves wasn't working correctly. Like, that's a serious issue. That's the type of issue that you get heart surgery for. Not just like, let's take some fucking medication and see what happens. But if this was something they figured to be a congenital issue, and then next thing you know, they can't find an issue. next thing you know, it's more or less gone. So in a big, massive, flashing neon strobe light, you're seeing steroid usage. Steroid usage fucking causes organ failure. It can cause heart issues. It can cause, you know, premature baldness. Holyfield. It can cause, I mean, you know, like a whole bunch of things here. You know, looking back on this, you see the telltale signs of this for a lot of these guys.
But what you're leaving out is it could lead you to seek out a miracle in the form
of televangelist. Benny Hinn.
Benny Hinn is going to look at that heart, put his hand on Holyfield's mighty, you know, not steroid-improved chest, and you're healed. Am I wrong?
You're not wrong, but I only wish that he would have gone to Bobby Chez, because Bobby Chez would have healed it sooner, and for free.
Well, in 2025, Bobby Chez is going to be back on the road, so get ready for that. I know I'm ready.
Making house calls. Dr. Chez. Boom!
Last Bobby Chez reference, but it was deserved. That is an accurate date, by the way, about when he's getting his driver's license. I'm not just pulling that out of my ass. I looked it up.
Well, he's going to be getting his driver's license back quicker than we get Ike Bayabuchi back from Nigeria. So at least, you know, we're kind of sliding up the urban myth ladder here. But, you know, this how do you recover from that? This third fight, you know, between Riddick Bowe and Evander Holyfield, it almost actually wound up being somewhat anomalous, because you would think that by this time it would be like they got nothing more to give, you know, that's it. But Holyfield actually wound up claiming that his heart issue had, later he claimed that his heart issue had hurt him in the third fight against Riddick Bowe. But it was still a pretty epic fight. And that, and funnily enough, this kind of, the third fight between Evander Holyfield and Riddick Bowe kind of reminds me of the rematch between Riddick Bowe and Andrew Golota. Because they're remembered for different things than kind of how they played out. Bowe Golota 2 obviously is remembered for the fact that Andrew Golota beat the shit out of Riddick Bowe's testicles and wound up getting disqualified for the second time for doing so. And rightfully so. I mean, dude, he landed like multiple testicle combinations on Riddick Bowe, and those types
I just have to say, Patrick, I take exception to that, because I thought they were higher than the shots that gave our boy Andre Ward a knockout victory over Kovalev.
You know, I will say there were, especially the early low blows in that rematch, they actually weren't nearly as bad as Riddick Bowe was making them out to be. I will say that. There were a couple that kind of looked a little borderline, but by that time, Andrew Golota should have just been not even throwing body punches. I mean, he should have just
right. And they even did a demonstration to show the effects of like a low blow wearing a cup, where they like put on a pair of like the cup guard, the padding guarding your dick and balls.
Yeah.
And they took a baseball bat to it and like swung it hard repeatedly so that you could hear the slap. And the guy who's getting struck, I don't remember if it was like who was being struck, but he's just like, I'm fine. I can't feel it. That's
nope.
Fine.
You know who that was? You know who that was?
Who was it?
That was Bernard Fernandez.
Oh, interesting. That's funny.
That was the dude who ran Ring Talk for a number of years. Oh my God, dude. That's hilarious. I forgot all about that.
The Philadelphia writer, right?
That's I don't remember where he came from, but I think he wound up settling in like Northern California, but he was like a beat writer for like Chicago, Philadelphia, something like that.
Sure.
But that's hilarious. I totally forgot about that. But I mean, my point that I was leading into was that it reminded me of that fight, because even though that's what the fight's remembered for, the fact that Andrew Golota beat the hell out of Riddick Bowe's penis, it was actually a really fun fight. It was a good fight. And it was a fight where Riddick Bowe lashed out and hurt Andrew Golota a couple times and knocked him down once. It was like, holy shit, where'd this come from? It was a great brawl. It's just that Andrew Golota fell apart and wound up screwing everybody. And actually, this third fight, Bowe Holyfield 3, was a really good fight, too. You could just tell that neither guy was the same, was the thing, that it was kind of fought on a slightly different level than the first two fights. But you had, some serious back-and-forth action in the first, like, 3 to 4 rounds that totally sapped Holyfield. By the time, like the end of the fourth came around, the dude was, like, dead. I remember watching and going, like, why is he so, like, what happened? And he was just, like, he looked like he was on the verge of death. Fuck, he might have been. But, and then he comes back, and he drops Bowe in, like, I think the fifth or sixth round, and... But then that's it. Like, that's pretty much it. I thought that was, like, his last hurrah, period. You know, like, his last hurrah for his career. That obviously didn't wind up being the case, but it was a really good fight.
Well, I think everybody thought, like, Bowe was out, you know, when he got knocked down. And Holyfield was charging forward, almost fell over him. I think Tyson had a similar thing against Terrell Biggs, where he knocks him down and almost falls out of the ring to land another punch. Had Holyfield landed that last one he was trying to land, it would have surely been over. But, it was amazing because Bowe gets up. That's the first time he'd ever been dropped. I think the only time he was ever dropped as a pro. I don't know that he's ever dropped as an amateur either. So it had all that drama. And then Holyfield was charging at him, I think, in the next round. And it looks like there might be another knockdown, and just gets clipped by this seemingly innocent left hook that was kind of hard to see. Even on the replay, you had to watch it 2 or 3 times. And it knocked Holyfield out, I think, for the first time in his career. So, fascinating third fight. I mean, so unexpected and dramatic. And I completely agree with you about Bowe Golota. Those were super exciting fights to watch. I mean, I thought Golota was going to take the fight for sure and knock out Bowe. Bowe was clearly past his prime and overwhelmed by Golota, but Golota just couldn't stop going after his balls or Andre Ward, you know, body shot knockout attempts.
That's right, yeah, Andre, the old Andre Ward treatment. You know, it's our dude Brian Campbell, who works for CBS now, worked for ESPN before, but worked for CBS now. One of the things that he frequently brings up when one of these fights comes up is the old guy fights. And I think that Holyfield Bowe 3 was kind of an old guy fight, even though it was only, 3 years after their initial fight. It was, they had taken so much out of each other that by the time they fought the third time, they weren't fighting the same against each other. You know, they were both a little more stationary. They were both a little less able to recover from what the other was landing. They were both a little slower in terms of their arm speed, especially Holyfield, because he'd packed on weight and muscle, and he was just a little bit more muscle-bound. He was still very effective, but nonetheless muscle-bound. And you just saw a different kind of fight, and in that way it kind of was an old guy fight. And in that way it was kind of fun. Like, it was kind of... It's like comparing, putting two guys who are willing to beat the shit out of each other in a ring versus putting two guys who kind of would rather just stay away against each other. You know, it's a different, there's a difference in terms of entertainment value, obviously. And the third fight was a very, very fun fight, but it was pretty rough, especially now looking back. And especially now that we've done this show and talked about the damage that they both accrued during this time, you look back at that third fight and perhaps just, you cringe a little bit. Oof. It's kind of rough.
Brutal fight. No, absolutely brutal fight. And I agree with you. I think there's a huge drama in old man fights. I think there's more drama in the Thrill in Manila than the first two fights of Ali Frazier, just because they're both available to get hit, and it becomes a contest of, almost like watching them do a marathon against each other. It's just that, it takes it to a different level when it's less about somebody able to athletically dominate one another, and it's more basic. And I think that's one of the things about Ali that's just so hard to – have anybody be compared to him is the young Ali is as glorious an athlete as Michael Jordan in his prime, but then the old Ali had the best chin of any heavyweight, arguably, and more willpower than anybody to just take a beating and endure what he had to in order to figure somebody out. There's just such completely different fighters with the Vietnam situation dividing his respective careers. Whereas, you know, and it's, I guess it's a little bit true with Tyson also, that early Tyson, the great Tyson, is a pressure counterpuncher. Post-prison Tyson, or really post-Kevin Rooney, is a slugger with exceedingly fast hands and a heavy hitter, but the footwork was never the same. He's a different fighter and is available to get hit in a way he just never was. First career Tyson, it was an event to see him get hit by a clean shot. Latter Tyson, he does get hit. Like anybody who's willing to stand up to him, he gets hit a lot, like as Holyfield demonstrated quite soon after this trilogy that we're discussing. So it's interesting when they get old and we see different facets of who they are.
And they wind up, like you said, it's like some of these things get stripped away. So it's almost, in a way, a slightly more pure version of fighting. It's you know, a more stripped down and basic version of fighting than, yeah. It's pretty interesting stuff, but this entire trilogy is pretty interesting, and I'm actually kind of surprised that they were even able to convince anybody to get back into that open air outdoor arena at Caesar's Palace for the third fight after what happened with the fan man shit. I mean, that's just wow. Even that in and of itself.
They must have had fucking like anti-aircraft guns at ringside.
I mean, Jesus, the way that the U.S. reacts to things, you know, they probably like gave everybody a gun in the crowd or something. But yeah, it's fun stuff, man. And if nobody really like has gone and watched any of these fights by now, just hopefully this inspired you to go watch them because they really were fun fights.
Spectacular fights. And I think it could all be kind of a gateway drug into that era, which is a really, really interesting era in terms of what happened in the 90s. Really, great characters, great talented guys, interesting fights that did happen, and a lot of really interesting fights that didn't happen that leave a lot of questions. We never got Bo Tyson, even though they're only 2 years apart. We never got Bo Lewis. We got Holyfield Lewis twice, which was fucking god-awful. But there are a lot of mixes there. I would have loved to have seen David Tua and Tyson fight. We saw Tua-Lewis fight, which was, you know, an interesting sort of comparative analysis of how Tyson would later do. But we did get three with Bo and Holyfield. And so it's nice that an era boasts something like that, where, you know, the ensuing decades too often got defined by the fights that didn't get made when they should have been made. This fight happened exactly when it should have happened the first time, and I think the next two happened in pretty quick succession. So, it's a really, really interesting era where a lot of interesting, surprising things happen with Tommy Morrison. You know, the Ray Mercer fight is so brutal. The Michael Bent situation with Morrison was fascinating. Morrison was right on his way to getting his Tyson fight. And then Tyson, of course, with the rape conviction and Buster Douglas, it just went in a totally different direction than anybody expected with his respected heavyweight reign.
It's a lot of things about this heavyweight era, like you said, are extremely intriguing. And there's much more to it than what a lot of people know, as hopefully you go back and listen to that Evander Holyfield versus George Foreman episode and you learn. There's a lot of stuff under the surface that pertains to today. That, you know, you can look directly at this and say, oh, that's why that happens now, or that's why that led down that direction or whatever. And Tommy Morrison is one of those figures in boxing history that a lot of people seem very drawn to for a number of reasons. Probably first and foremost because he was a hard-hitting white heavyweight that was fairly successful. But nonetheless, you know, he's a very intriguing figure and really fit well in this late 80s, early 90s schema. in boxing, and hopefully we'll get to return soon with a show about somebody like Tommy Morrison.
Well, he could teleport, and he also conquered AIDS before any sort of vaccine was created. So for those accomplishments alone, I think he deserves at least a plaque in the history of boxing, if not science.
One could say that he's like the Jonas Salk of heavyweight boxing. One could say.
I wouldn't say it, but I'm okay with you saying it.
Right. One could say it. All right, everybody. Well, I think that this was a really fun show. Hopefully, Brent and I will get to do some more in the future. But like I said, Eris and I will return for some more history stuff. Don't you worry. Brent, spectacular stuff, dude.
And just remember, you got 6 years before Blame Bobby's back on the road. So make the most of it. Because
that's right.
The charm for that DUI.
Well, it's about to be 2019, so we're just flying there. Hashtag Blame Bobby. Everybody, thank you. If you listened in today, thank you. We appreciate it. And everybody who listens in later, also appreciate it. If you wouldn't mind, if you're on Twitter, go on to Twitter. Follow us there. Follow Brin at Brinicio, B-R-I-N-I-C-I-O. Follow me, Patrick Connor, at Boxing History. And also, if you wouldn't mind going to the Facebook page for Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio, give that a like. Helps us out. Also helps us out is if you go to iTunes, if you listen that way, throw us a rating on iTunes, leave a message or two. Always appreciated. Bryn, we'll be back, man. Good stuff. Thank you.
Thanks, Patrick. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Talk to you again.
All right. Take it easy, everybody.